Welcome to another edition of Wordplay, Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. We'll be right back after some tunes. This is Sebastian Matthews, and Jeff Davis is here, and we are at 103.5 WPVM, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains. Jeff, hello.
Howdy, Sebastian. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Good, good, good.
We have a special show. We're going to have Jeff Davis himself read, and not in studio, but a recording of him reading, what, 6 months ago? Or?
Oh, no, this is like a couple of years ago.
Yeah. This is your first... Mm-hmm. Reading for Nature's.
First reading for Nature's, April 28th, 2006.
Wow. Yeah.
My first extended reading in about 20 years when I did it.
Yeah.
And it shows. I'm a little bit, my chops are, you know, not quite sharp.
That's okay. And we have it in two sessions. We're going to play the first session now and then take a break, do the calendar, come back. And so a couple words about the show. Is at the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center.
Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center.
Good crowd.
Broadway, good crowd. And it was the publication reading for Nature's when it came out.
Great. So, okay, well, let's start with that, and then we'll take a break.
Okay, I'm not going to bore you any longer. I'm just going to turn over the evening to Jeff. This is his evening. It's been a long time coming. I can't tell you, I couldn't be any happier. It seemed like this day, this evening, was never going to get here. Like I said, 30 years. But it's here now, and Jeff is here. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Davis.
Oh. Thanks very much, Thomas. A generous introduction indeed. If any of you poets get a chance to work with Thomas as an editor, it's a great experience because Thomas is a real editor. Not only would this book probably not have come into existence without Thomas, but it's immeasurably better because Thomas worked on it. Thomas is like one of the most astute readers that I've ever run into, ever crossed trails with, so thank you. And it is great to be here, given the affinities my work has and that I've had with Black Mountain College over the years. Creeley was one of my teachers, and even the people who weren't here who were teachers for me, like Robin Blazer, all had deep connections to Black Mountain College. So it's an honor to be here where it's you know, the mission of this place is not just the preservation in some sense of, you know, like a museum of the Black Mountain legacy, but also to encourage further creative work in the spirit of the college. And that's what real preservation is all about. Okay. Poems. You know, when I first tried to read Charles Olson many years ago, who was one of the great Black Mountain poets, he was really hard to grok, you know, hard to get into for me. I was coming out of a tradition. I was reading Randall Jarrell, Robert Lowell, of course, had read T.S. Eliot and all those guys, the great modernist. So Olson seemed like a really strange creature to me initially. But then I went to Buffalo, and there were still like Olson vibes all through the State University of New York at Buffalo. And so I began to actually read his work. Creeley, of course, every time we would talk to Creeley, Creeley would say, you know, you need to read this. You need to read that. Creeley was a lifelong proponent of Olson's work. And of course, I mean, their correspondence so far fills 10 volumes, I think, for the first 2 years of it. So they were in constant communication. It was Olson who brought Creeley to Black Mountain College when Creeley was, I think, 24 years old, and not an old guy, and Olson not that much older, for that matter. Olson at that time had published like 7 poems. He was in the beginning of his career as a poet. But he was at Black Mountain College. He started writing things like The Human Universe, Projective Verse, his letter to Elaine Feinstein, and the other documents in poetics that have come to define the Black Mountain School. And it was, you know, looking back, years later, I realized that Olson and Human Universe really nailed the two terms that were valuable for me, which is, of course, the human and the world. And for me, particularly, the human, the other, the world, and cosmos, I would say. Those four terms became critical. So let me share some. My initial work was to address the other, the significant other, you know, however, wherever one looks to find the other, the intimate other, you know, every human relationship runs into the same issues, i.e., with presence, with love, with delight, there's also the possibility of the absence of presence, of delight. So we all face the same issues. And I've tried to address some of those along the way. And Thomas is right, some of these do go back 30 years. I thought, when I was getting ready to come tonight, I found this photograph of myself in 1971 when I started these. And at that time, I had red hair that was like, you know, shoulder length or, you know, mid-back length, full beard, and so on. So I thought I'd you know, like, paste it on the front of the lectern or something like that. But anyway, some of these are poems by this very hairy, you know, hippie guy. So anyway. This is to the Muse. I wanted to take you to a place I did not know the way past names mask to your face. Lost, amazed, I came to your words on a rock, waited, meet me. I went on to a place I thought you made, a bed we moved on an arc of blood through sleep. Silent, you gave me a dream of your naked eyes, my lost home. No place it was. I found you. This is without last words. Some life stilled in the resin of her eyes, trapped in their amber, frozen, unable to open its wings and fly. Inside, still the echo of the flight struggling to escape. The wings up, forceful, cold. Or like a magnolia cased in ice by the late snow, the whole bough broken off, fallen, and not yet dead, but without another way to go. This is listening to her breathe. The deepest breath of the body that has slept in the lung like coal brought up by this trundling sleep. Perfume of the interior, that depth, past words, odors of secrets. Something has burned in this air, most personal, like a dream she had forgotten that has now consumed its shape. When a star has exploded, great nebulae quietly abandoned the universe. Her waste dead, come to be numbered and reborn. A wind rises to her from the sea. This is a poem that's ostensibly about a painting by Georges Braque, one of the great Cubist masters. It's called The Bird Returning to Its Nest, which is an actual Braque painting, and a wonderful one. One of his late works that, if you don't know, you should, you know, track it down, track it down. Back to the nest, a cave, a boat on the sea of earth to live in it. Some haste to the form of her flight. She comes from fields of wheat and rose hedges, which have filled her wings' shadows. She might have flown nowhere, her eyes cooling obsidian. She is tired, but it is more simple. She does not arc down for one night only. She is given, like an anchor, she does not move her wings into this depth, this dream she remembers as she returns to the nest and three eggs, empty of everything but the descent. This one is called Heavenly Blues, after the morning glory of the same name. True, our joined hands also interlace the fingers of death, the invisible, the unknown, who also will not let go. But like the heavenly blue, we climb on light entwined and make our dead vines trellis through thorns. This was the cotyledon. A cotyledon, for those of you who are not gardeners, is like the first stage of growth of a seed. If you plant a seed, a bean, or any seed, the first two sets of leaves are the leaves that were actually in the seed, waiting to emerge, and that are wakened by the process of germination. Two lovers lie together like two leaves inside the finished seed. Bound, asleep, to the root, the long tunnels and subway paths, which end nowhere. A door, through which each day, drop by drop, a river seeps from the rock and rises through their flesh into morning. Charles Olson once famously told Robin Blazer that he would trust him anywhere with image, but not with syntax. And Robin Blazer took that as a challenge and has dedicated the rest of his life, fortunately he's still with us, to demonstrating just how far you could take syntax. And even what has been called, in the case of Blazer's work, I think it was George Buttrick who came up with the term parataxis, because Blazer's work does not, you can't diagram it. You know, I don't know if you went, when I went to school, we learned how to diagram sentences. You know, it's like, you know, subject, you know, verb, object, you know, prepositional phrase, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can't do that with Robin Blazer's work, quite deliberately. You know, I was fortunate enough to wind up in Vancouver at a time when Blazer was still actively teaching at Simon Fraser, and so I used to audit his classes, and so some of these don't diagram either. It's just the way it is. And of course now that's like a postmodern norm. If you read Forrest Gander or a hundred others, especially the language poets, I mean, before there were the language poets, there was Robin Blazer, who was like shredding syntax and turning it into something quite other. So it's become like a postmodern norm, but at the time, Blazer was really the pioneer, and it's a shame his work is not better known here in the States. He's considered a Canadian poet, even though he's from like Idaho. Grew up, became a poet in California, in San Francisco, was part of the great San Francisco Renaissance, a companion of Robert Duncan and Jack Spicer and all those cats. But then, after work there, moved to Vancouver and dropped off the radar of, American poetry, apparently, but has done incredible work. And if you ever get a chance to track down his book, The Holy Forest, it's an amazing piece of work. So, and some of these apparently will diagram, but not from this point on. This one's the link. Yeah. Your arms filled with chains of frenetic dust, your tongue a ruby cenotaph. Lady, caught in your coils, let me delve the runes of your blood and drink from your forgotten mouth, full of the alphabets of butterflies. Let me, lost, come to the first word. And this is the twining. Together we sleep busily, planting seeds invisible that open in day's light into intense tendrils, helices, to bind us tangled like vines, separate, inseparable, as they find their way upward out of night. This is from a series. Many of these were actually published in a chapbook last fall, which I urge you to buy immediately up there, but called Transits of Venus. Others occur in a series called Bodies of Knowledge, which is only in here. So this is the first of the Bodies of Knowledge, which has an epigraph from Hildegard von Bingen from her Canticles of Ecstasy. Your holy body has conquered death, and your belly has illuminated every created thing. She, of course, is at least ostensibly talking about Christ. But it's an amazing sensual take on Christ. Okay, the body, only flesh, chalice, altar, is blessed and holy. Timelessness can bloom through even muscle, membrane, blood. Two travel together, spirits, mortal embodiments, beyond themselves, and come to an other place and rest briefly beyond their bliss in a sanctuary neither would have ever thought to find. And let's see, this is the well. Her eyes, luminous torches, lit the dark halls I thought we would walk forever, and in the fields beyond our hearts built a house of breath and dust. Nothing now, the door, the walls devoured on the wind's pyre. The maps we made likewise charred, no longer chart new crossroads where we meet and laugh, surprised. Lost in what was past and seen, therefore, clearly, at last, so it always seems, I moved on to see what opened to the intention to do so. On the way, I stopped to make love from time come always past what either I had in mind. Water in the well dug into the unseen river at the roots of two hills in the hidden dark after the clarifying descent through the buried rock, tangible, wet, and there, abandoned, found. I knew the place, though unremembered, to be the ground where I once began and stayed to stand in that place again, again. And this is the point, which is like a locus geographically. So after the storm, the beach is littered with debris, our lives also after the tumult, and it will not be regathered into one sheath. Without the imagination of the whole, love's intention to cohere, what was bound thereby scatters, floats off, tide by tide. Not that the storm was external, an event we watched at safe distance, or battered, hunkered through. It entered us. We were it, painfully. Our shores were littered in the exhausted calm after it passed, with seaweed, shells, boat timbers tossed up from the deepest sea, and we awoke salt-tongued among the devastation. The current turns, finding new direction along land's boundary, and as it slows, rounding into the new channel, meets the inlet's counterflow. There, all it has gathered, all it has been given, sand, shells, debris, everything it has carried suspended, all ever thrown by storm into its flow drops, and the point gathers outward. What I called mine, I do release to drift where it will, and the tide carries it. No longer in quest to be in love or in possession of, as I had imagined it, but no, I stand in condition of shared life, commitment common enough to children growing, grown, to know what I called mine in the name of love never was. No fossil teeth of sharks at the point today, just shells in their third lives. Creatures dead, eaten, mined, taken as foundation by minute architects. And then these dead too, the riddled complex, rolled, pounded, scoured, delivered by the tide to this point, tablets in an unknown tongue, language of a world long gone, and one still yet to come. A lot of these are written in the voice of some character named I, which is a common convention in English and American poetry, certainly. And it's a curious character, this I. I've always liked one of the things that was still floating around Buffalo from Olson's tenure there when I got there was a project called the Curriculum of the Soul. And if you get a chance to track these fascicles down, there are some 20 of them. And they were all based on a proposal that Olson drafted for another poet named Jack Clark when he was there. And Clark and his friend Al Glover, who's another wonderful, you know, very, very interesting poet, took it upon themselves to issue fascicles to cover all the subjects in Olson's proposal. And they drafted amazing poets, you know, other poets, to write these fascicles. And the series was just finished like last year, you know, 2 years ago, I guess now, with volumes on Mind and by Mike Bone, who's another American poet who now lives in Canada, and Lisa Jarneau, who's many of you probably will know, an amazing poet who also studied with Creeley in Buffalo as an undergraduate. So if you get a chance to track those down, one of the fascicles was on Novalis. And Novalis was a German Romantic poet right at the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries. And he wrote an incredible poem, one incredible poem at least, called Hymn Tonight, that's been translated many times, fabulous poem. But he spent, he died when he was 28, like most of the Romantics, you know, like not destined for a long life. But the rest of his work consists of fragments of something that he envisioned as an encyclopedia. And in fact, he called it an encyclopedia. And among those fragments are just incredible bits of cosmology, of psychology, This is like I happen to have a copy of Novalis's one book of his encyclopedia. This is from book 9 of the encyclopedia, which is his work is still hard to find. This came out in Vancouver in like the 1970s, and he was pretty far out. This is fragment number 1736, Cosmology. Hereafter, one must divide God and nature. God has nothing to do with nature. He is the goal of nature, that with which it should eventually harmonize. Nature shall become moral, whereby, incidentally, Kant's moral God and morality appear in a totally different light. The moral God is something far higher than the magical God. There must be infinite knowledge, infinite persons, infinite moralists, infinite gods, just as there are infinite dimensions. Heterogeneous things can only approach one another. Nature shall become moral. We are its teachers, its moral targets, its moral tangents, its moral stimulants. Does morality allow itself, like reason, etc., to be objectified and organized? Visible morality. The doctrine of man's relation. Because we are now still a foreign stimulus for nature, our contact with nature is also only temporal. It gradually cuts us out again. Perhaps it is a reciprocal secretion. We are simultaneously in and outside of nature. Which is not too dissimilar to Wordsworth's take on nature. If you read Tintern Abbey, for instance, he finds nature as something that's half created and half discovered. It's out there, but we know it through language. We know it through human consciousness, and we don't know it otherwise. We can make stabs at it using language, but ultimately, it's a, don't want to say a doomed attempt, but it's something you can never really get to. There's like an infinite regress. So what we know of it and what we can say of it is based on our own consciousness. One of the other wonderful sections of the encyclopedia is I is the absolute communal place, the nexus. So it's a place where we all meet. We've all got one. We are in our particularity. Before we get into the nature, the poems that are directly try to get to nature, I'd like to read another short elegy. This is called Another Flight, in memoriam for Ruy Hayes, who was a pilot in the Army Air Corps way back when planes were still made out of canvas and wood. Hard to let them go, though they're done, dozing already into the next incarnation. Or last, or earlier memories, young faces seen with eyes young still, somewhere inside these we watch glimmer dimly. We see the pain, like the mud and naked earth when the runway is under construction. More and more ready, he taxis up and back on the fresh pavement, ready for takeoff, to lift once more into the empyrean, rises at last after a slow ascent, aloft suddenly clear of the flight plan, and does not come down. Only a little dust drifts to the windblown ground.
You're listening to Jeff Davis, reading from the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center back in 06. This is WPVM. Sustainability starts at home. Join Maine in fostering sustainability right here in Western North Carolina, from weather to environmental news to local farmers markets, alternative energy sources, and biofuels. Check it all out online at sustainablewnc.org. Get connected and get involved. Find out what's happening to promote good, clean living and good, clean, green living, and who's doing it. That's sustainablewnc.org.
authors we've had recently on Wordplay, Catherine Min, has a new book out, or it's actually your first book, but it's now out in paperback. Is that right, Catherine?
Right.
When's it coming out? When's
it
coming out?
It comes out on Tuesday, February 12th.
February the 12th. Cool.
It's put up by Anchor Books, and it's quite nice looking, I think.
Beautiful, beautiful job. Yeah, yeah. So check your bookstores. It's $13.95 in the U.S. and well worth it. If you listened to our interview with Catherine a few weeks ago, it was a real delight. So yeah,
and we'll have it back on the air again. Yeah. If you're trying to podcast, I think we've had some difficulties of late. Try again in a week or so, and we'll probably play some old shows again.
Yeah.
So we'll have Catherine's show, and we'll probably have her back on again too.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, both UNCA and Warren Wilson are sponsoring two poets in town next week, Ross Gay and Patrick Rizal. They're going to read together Friday night coming up at 7 o'clock at Malaprops, and that's going to be an awesome show. But they're also reading each on Thursday night. Patrick Rizal will read at the Laurel Forum at Carpen at 7 on UNCA campus, and that's the Laurel Forum in Carpen Hall, and on the Warren Wilson campus, at Sage Cafe, Ross Gay will be reading at 8 o'clock. So try to catch those readings if you can. And we will be in touch with you as we go forward with all the events, winter and spring, poetry and the like.
Coming up a lot.
You're listening to Phil Lesh right now. This is My Favorite Things. And we're going to come right back to some of Jeff reading at the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center. Jeff, you said you had a few notes, some few things, corrections that you had to make.
I completely screw up the anecdote of Robert Creeley talking about Wittgenstein. And I'll maybe say another word about it after you hear the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. So let's go back to that show, and we'll talk to you at the other side.
So what follows is a collection, really, of poems that try to approach articulation of experience, our experience of the natural world, which we have so abundantly here. This one's called The Bridge, and it also includes a reference to what was my favorite rock and roll band at the time. Keeping in mind, this is the hairy guy with the full beard. This is like 1972, when this band was lucky to play before an audience of like 2,000 people on the East Coast. But I'm sure most of you look of an appropriate age to catch the reference. So, the bridge. The syntax of a magnolia unravels in the dream each flower passes into a trajectory through forms. A long bridge leads from the earth through these limbs, all built by the eye of the seed, turned in the roots spiral from veil to veil, a bridge cast from the ash of the flower. Grateful, dead, charred petals channel the air. This is Water Level Road. The road follows bridges up the valley, water made against the flow. Water knows a single way from high rock. Descend. The mountain reaches into the clouds for rain, and water swirls, lifts the stone, cuts the earth from under it, rolls it beyond obstruction, makes the slope. The way water knows parts, breaks open the way down and up. Beyond where the river begins, the first spring rivulet over the divide separates directions, and flow likewise descends on the other side. Water knows the way does also extend. The Cherokee people have a ceremony called going to the water, which they do and still do, historically have done for generations, millennia probably, where that's somewhat like our baptism in the Christian church, because it's a matter of purifying, of clarifying, of ridding oneself of confusion, making oneself ready for a fresh start. This is called going to the water. The water fall, the rain falls and breaks the order of words to penetrate thoughts and interstices and wash the rivulets and the mind thinking of them clear again a moment to the unknown. Downstream, another juncture of water to waters uncover the cold rock, strip dirt off down to nets of roots, hold laurel, oak, and hemlock tight and live. Leaves drop in and are carried off. Limbs are taken off to rot. And the water leaves what holds deep to what the strong earth itself, through all uplift and turmoil, does not unfold. And this one's the traffic. The leaves break the bud and lean back to face outward, catch the full light. They dream. They do not have time. They dig deep roots to swing out from and fill. The root insists. Between the leaves, a bud tip pushes up, spreads them to find its exit, and rushes beyond a new road. The young depart. They do things that happen to them to do. Rust gnaws the leaves' green steel. When they fall and lie down to knit themselves into the ground, no one watches. No one stops on the throughway. Robert Creeley in the 90s used to tell this story whenever he would do a reading about the argument between Wittgenstein and Bertrand Russell, which happened. Wittgenstein was a student of Russell's and in philosophy at Oxford. And they had many a discussion. One of them involved language. And so as Creeley would tell it, the issue was, Wittgenstein said, well, think of a rhinoceros. So Russell said, no, there's no rhinoceros in this room. And Wittgenstein said, there is. Now there is, right? Because he had created it by language. So this is a cautionary note to Bob called Noetic Issues on the Trail. In the city, we can drink wine and wonder, does the world actually exist as other than a shared abstraction, or we, and how? Words of being past the time we seem to be in. But on the steep trail, just hold on to thee, a tug will tell you if it's firm, rock, and mind where your foot lands. Yes, the mind is many, and the red flesh the mind thinks it is separate from is substrate, ganglion, synapse, and leaping thought, a few sparks flashing through a circuit's gap. And so the matrix forms a lattice of new memories, insights, and a story arrives, sound in mind, in time. I have a bottle of wine in mind, it says, to share with you. This next is a series of poems written as a serial, more or less as a serial poem in the very much in the West Coast tradition. So, but it's a sensible subject as the rhododendron. It's Strata rhododendron. For Alan Lynch, who was an actual artist, lived over in Montford. Some of you probably knew him. Zen monk, wonderful watercolorist, a great teacher in many ways, but cranky, misogynistic. Let's see, what else we can say about Alan? But anyway, to acknowledge the whole person of Alan Lynch. When the mind vanishes, this is, but he introduced me to Bodhidharma, so I'm forever grateful to Alan's spirit, wherever it may be. When the mind vanishes, the real appears. Learn to see. And that's from Bodhidharma's sermon, one of his sermons. This is geography, the boundary. The granite cliffs edge zones of life, the transition between compressed by the ascent up steep palisades into a few miles as the crow flies from the low land, hollies thriving under pines in simple shadow, to the ridge crest beyond which the light lingers at dusk in the steep woods westward and reveals the broad dark green leaves, the rose tree still sunning in hollows opened up by the winter wind. Buds prolific, clustered in thickets, it thrives in the high severity, clinging to the thin earth of sky, which remakes earth constantly from the gone, the left, that also leaves palimpsest life, lives, and deaths in the high land, beyond the boundary of regions. The Forester's Eye. To the forester's eye, the forest has order and structure wrapped in its green veils. Oaks, poplars, pines, the canopy. Below them, dogwoods, white flowered in the thin shade of new spring leaves. Hollies beneath, glossy, and rhododendrons. Bud sheathed still furled, pointed beyond the end of winter. Blue Ridge, how many million years kindle in your dark leaf, magnolia born, magna folia older than the rose, another chapter of the unknown from the lush turbulence before us, all descended, relic, ancient, among those which remain through all change. 40 million years riding the blue ridges as they rise, as they crumble and subside, and are again uplifted, still glistening, drenched in April rain. Thickets. The settlers call them hells, these dense entanglements of root and limb, impassable, large enough, the rhododendron loves like company to get lost in, like the hiker half-starved arrived at Kephart's door. I have been out in the laurel thickets now these 3 days and 2 nights, so nothing could have induced me, he said, to leave this trail once I found it, until I could see out to a house on one side or the other. The settlers call them hells for cause, easier to escape the clutches of than once tangled. Kephart, of course, is Horace Kephart, who's one of the great naturalists. And that's an actual quote from his Our Southern Highlanders. Green River. There must be water to open the earth to the digging root to ease its entry deeper. Here it wore the land hollow. Low willows watch water slip over stones through thick rhododendron, tree rose, kalmia, laurel wood. This was your river, lady of the rivers, when I came to you lost in my own thicket of mind's perplexity. And you bathed me in the torpor of a vivid sleep, anointed me, joined me to the body of the land your river passed through, took me beyond myself and the argument I let die as it mingled with the cool air, lost among the leaves. You lost Agisegua. And still the water that she was remains to find its way always down through the scattered stones of her forgotten sanctuary, creek to river to ocean, there raised up to spirit once more into the moving ether, to fall on these hills as rain, opening the soil, sustaining By her stream, the oaks, the rose tree, lichens, moss, and all below. Agasegua was the Cherokee great lady, or great woman, great female. Not a river goddess, but here addressed as one. The stones, gray lichens cover the rocks, and beneath the rocks, lifting their difficult bodies from the earth, the roots of everything entwine. And with them, the tunnels of the mole, the caves of ants and worms, deep larvae still asleep, infinitesimal archaea, to unravel all the layered complexity above and under, last, within, nothing lives but the luminous emptiness, the central stone. The strategy. In the green thyme flower, hidden amid the taller oaks and pines, or on the bare, bitter crags in small company, survive. Deliver the magenta text of rocks, of the leaves long dead, broken from their limbs, layered in the rich earth, angels of the stones. These are, it's curious to read these, I mean, especially in reference to people like the Objectivist or Charles Olson, because Olson would have just chunked, dropped like bits of, you know, textbook stuff on rhododendrons into the poem. And I felt compelled, you know, to make it lines. So anyway, it is. But there's, it's all true. Everything in there about rhododendrons is true. 40 million years here. So one of the great plant, one of the signatures of our era. And this is like, we're now in the third Appalachian orogeny. You know, we were privileged to be here. This is the third time the Appalachian Mountains have been here in pretty much the same spot. And rhododendrons go back through at least 40 million of those years. The only other place rhododendrons live is in China. China, Tibet, that part of the world. So there's a section that will appear someday that that deals with the geography of rhododendrons, but they seemed you know, like an appropriate signature for this place. And they also have interesting properties. This one is called Strata Melissa. For all its sweetness, the honey of the rose tree is treacherous and must be taken just so. Set and setting, the good doctor said, decisive. The green honey, melichloron, and I'm translating in the line, melichloron means green honey, it's Greek. From the spring of the year when the flowers of the rhododendron open, poison, even the ancients knew. Sheepbane, lambkill, speak of the lethality of the leaf's alkaloids, and bees took these from their flowering to their combs. Roman legions marching through the Caucasus, not familiar with the pharmacon, ate the honey left for them as a parent gift near Trebizond. When they were stoned, stumbling, sick, dizzy, delusional from its sweet sting, the villagers returned to hack them down. Hundreds never descended the inner promontories they had climbed, bodies left on rocks beside trails to turn slowly into bones. But taken otherwise, as the bee girls, Melissae, knew its ways, honey on their tongues, stood through veils between worlds, words, and spoke oracles. There are certain holy ones dwell under a ridge at Parnassus, Apollo said, teachers of foreseeing when they are inspired, eating melichloron, speak truth, inquire of them, and delight your heart. Melissa, your honey on my tongue, do come make sweet my song. That's embodied in that is the reference to Apollo is from the Homeric hymn to Demeter. So anyway, a great, great early Greek poem. Probably not written by Homer, whoever Homer was, but known as the Homeric hymns ever since. The last of this series so far is Notes in the Common Key, strata epilogue for Robert Creeley. Strata of mind, of world, world in mind, mind in world it made, locked as always in embrace, each the other's dream, mind grown in world from world, all animal but diffident in its apparent power, its illusion always wants to be different. Beside myself, where would I be? The only I I'll ever know as one, and from inside, outside, inside, and out. Here in mind, in skin, is first home for any one. And I'll close with a poem that this moves more towards fable. So, morpheme into mytheme. But again, the primary character is this strange character named I. It's called Anecdotes of Ishara, and Ishara was a Sumerian river goddess. I've died, now I live in the river, is the epigraph. It's the message of the man in the waters, as explained by a Kung commentator. They're the Kung people are like one of the oldest groups until recently living independently on Earth. They're also known as the Kalahari Bushmen, quote. Very, very ancient tribal culture. Anyway, the invocation. Ishara, queen of Pisgah, make me a cave of your diamond hair. Lady most high, lie with me there, and as I sleep, repair my broken soul. Be with me, lady, grant me grace. As I light this offering of air, my breath upon your high altar. The settling. The temple from the seafloor rose and raised rings. The temple from the seafloor rose and raised wings of stone that glowed gossamer on either side. Between them a court in which she stood, and in her hands outstretched held a lamp that glowed blue-white through the lambent gloom. Traveler, light your way, she said, you who have come so far beneath the waves. This is the deepest temple of her, and her priestess I am, Ishara of Pisgah. The encounter. Lady, I find the way of the heart leads down, leads into dark. I have come in search of her, the exact motion of her embodied dance. I know, I knew her when our glances met from whatever life we intertwined. We had, it seemed, the same heart split, and then in time's mercy a moment rejoined, resonating with the same memories, dreams from the same sleep. She was my awakening. As all men do, I left her changed. The release. Hold her I could not, lady, and could but release water through my hands. She cascaded into the lush air, luminous, receding, and after her my heart fell, my blood still locked to hers, into the river which rolls always at the bottom of her soul. Broken, I could only cry at this voyage she embraced so quickly. She is the largest absence. I searched for the signature of her sex in the autumn air, full of goldenrod and Queen Anne's lace, sought out her shadow on the way we walked in spring through white berry flowers and trilliums blood red, watched for her ghost dancing among the shadows of the shaking leaves, then listened for the echo of her voice between the fall of waves, between the seagulls' collapsing cries. So much at stake, only the survival of the spring, the crocus, the shooting star, the violet. And without the spring, no ripening, no full sheaths, no seed, since she made herself a gift to the speechless one, the other, the lost queen of my sleepless night. Still desolate, I try again and again to reach, to touch, to delve the darkness I thought I'd known so well. Lady, if you can, let me read once more those runes and drink from her mouth the well I could not forget. The gift. Ishara spoke, who knows what we will find, the place where we shall come. First, to give your pain relief and mend the heart you've torn, let me bless you with a dream. There's nothing to remember, nothing to regret, nothing to forget, nothing to gather, nothing left to spill, so let the bucket drop into the sea to fill. The dark road you have come down in search of her leads to this beginning. Drink this cup, and in the dream I drank as she offered it. Now you can find me when you close your eyes, to fear of what might occur, to sorrow for the gone. Each day nourish me in the time, and she spake an ancient paradigm. Where you go, I will go. Where you lie down, there will I lie down. I will be with you always, always returned. This lamp will light the way through dark, even in the daylight. Lift it. You are not alone, but engaged in the timeless ascent. When you wake, this will prove no simple reverie. Let me be with you. Whoever among men who walk the earth has seen these mysteries is blessed. Whomever the goddess loves among men who walk the earth, he is blessed. Embrace me, she said, and when I did, she whom I held was in my arms and not, and in an instant gleam stood in me speaking. I am she said, I am I, her, the lost, as you could see me. Sing my song, she said, and celebrate the rites through which I live. Reawakening. I woke and turned and saw one shining alone in her face that I had always known, raising a hand to me. And so I moved as she drew me from before, before all losses, before all pain, before all memory, before all change, back. She took me in her grace beyond my very name, saved me by her blessing, her embrace, and leads me now to sing her praise. Thanks very much for coming out tonight. Appreciate it. (Laughter)